I call this meeting of the City Council to order. Councilmember Sturdivant, will you lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance, please?
I'm glad to.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, Councilman Sturdivant. Let's go move on to the approval to roll call. Excuse me.
Laura?
Councilmember Burbo?
Here.
Councilmember Moreno?
Here.
Councilmember Sturdivant?
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Fonzi?
Here.
And Mayor O'Malley is absent.
Thank you, Laura. And I'll be chairing the meeting tonight since our Mayor Tom O'Malley is out and he is ill this evening. We wish him well. Speedy recover. Our first item is approval of the agenda. Is there anyone who would like to either approve it or change it?
I will move approval.
Second.
Okay, motion by Councilmember Moreno, second by Councilmember Sturdivant. Roll call vote, please.
Councilmember Moreno?
Yes, ma'am.
Councilmember Sturdivant?
Yes.
Councilmember Burbo?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Fonzi?
Yes.
Motion passes.
Thank you. All right, we have a presentation tonight, and this will be a water update by John Neal of the Atascadero Mutual Water Company. Welcome, John.
Good evening. How are you this evening? So I was, Rochelle asked me to give you an update on our water resources, probably in response to the low rainfall year that we've had. So I'll just touch on rainfall briefly. Year-to-date rainfall, and this is through this morning, we have 3.34 inches of rain. Okay. Believe it or not, that's not the lowest it's ever been. 1924, we had 2.5 inches of rain at this period in time. So the likelihood of getting average rainfall is basically zero at this point, although we have had March rainfall totals of as much as 13 inches. So again, we have 100 years of rainfall data. This is certainly not, it's likely not going to be the driest year, but it will be a dry year. Fortunately, the groundwater basin we draw water from is fairly resilient. The rain that we got last year essentially filled the Atascadero Basin. We got about 29 inches of rain last year. So we started out the peak irrigation season with water levels at fairly high levels. To put that in perspective, and what I look at is rainfall, but I more look at well levels. You know, how much water is in the ground? Right now, or a good year, well levels are about 18 feet below the ground surface in our main well field. Back in 2015, well levels in January were 97 feet below the ground surface. So that's, we're right in the height of the drought. This year, they're about 36 feet below ground surface right now. So there is this groundwater, we have been pumping it, it is diminishing. We have not been taking Nacimiento water. On March 1st, we're going to start taking Nacimiento water, about 100 acre feet per month, which is about 1 million gallons a day. And so that'll be put into our recharge basin in our main well field, and that'll bring those well levels up. We demonstrated that in 2014. We took approximately 5 million gallons a day of Nacimiento water, and well levels actually came up all year. Several things we have going for us. Our water demand on a year-over-year basis is declining. The amount of water we're pumping right now on an annual basis is about the same as it was in the early 80s. Water demand peaked in about 2000. We produced about 2.2 billion gallons of water. Right now, we're producing about 1.5 billion gallons of water a year, which is about the same level as 1983. So even though there's growth in our service area, we're offsetting that through conservation measures, et cetera. I do not anticipate that we will declare a water shortage condition this year. There is abundant Nacimiento water out there. Right now, the lake is about 40% full with about 154,000 acre feet. Just to put that in perspective, that's about 6.5 times the volume of water in Santa Margarita Lake when it's full. So really good resource, very reliable. We can take up to 3,244 acre-feet a year off of that project if we need it. I don't see us taking anything near that this summer. If we have another dry year next year, then we'll probably be taking more Nacimiento water. But the water company did buy into that project just for these dry cycles that we go through. We had mandated conservation measures 2 years ago. They were mandated by the state. We argued against them. The water company purchased water to get us through drought periods, but the state basically ignored us and said, nope, you're going to have your customers cut back 28%. They've since rescinded that. They've allowed us to what they call self-certify if we have reliable water resources. And again, I don't anticipate us entering into a water shortage condition this year. So we're not going to be asking for conservation measures. We're not going to be imposing watering restrictions as far as the number of days of the week. The state has imposed permanent restrictions on certain uses of water. For example, you have to repair plumbing leaks within 24 hours, and these are mandated by the state. You can't have runoff from landscaped areas. Outdoor watering hours, you can't water between 10 a.m. and 5 p.m. You can't irrigate after a rain event. You can't wash hard surfaces off, those type of things. Those are in our policy of wise and beneficial use, and I think they're also in the city's policy on water use. So basically that's it. We're in good shape going into the summer. We're in our budget process now. I'm anticipating we'll produce about the same amount of water next year as we did last year, which is about 1.5 billion gallons a year. So with that, if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Neal. Are there any questions? Ms. Moreno?
John, to what do you attribute the use of the $1.5 billion being similar to, you know, essentially 30-some-odd years ago? Is it conservation efforts? What do you see as led to our reduced usage?
Primarily, yes. It is conservation. It's a heightened awareness by the community that it's a limited resource. The drought was a wake-up call to a lot of people. We learned our lesson back in 1990, to be honest with you, which is the last significant drought. Before that time, the water company was out there saying, we have unlimited water resources, use as much as you want, et cetera. Well, that backfired really bad. If you recall, I think it was early 1991, we were out there telling people they had to cut back. We were actually rationing water because we had mechanical failures of our systems. Since then, we've changed our operations considerably. We don't rely on two or three large production wells to meet the community's needs. We have 17 active wells now. So we sort of mechanically we built redundancy into the system, and we don't rely on those wells to produce high volumes of water in drought situations. So that has a large effect. It's also when in 1990, we implemented a conservation program. We hired Jim Patterson as a full-time conservation coordinator. And those efforts are paying off. I mean, those years of education and outreach and have really paid off, and people are changing what their expectations are as far as water use, especially with landscaping. Because that's about half of the water we supply in a given year that goes on landscaping.
I think when you go to Southern California and there's never seems to be a drought there, maybe Jim needs to go to Southern California and teach them all conservation. But anyway, wonderful. Thank you.
Okay,
good report.
Welcome.
Councilmember Sturdivant.
So in a non-drought year, what would be a good rainfall average total for us?
Oh, that's a good question. I should have. It's the average, the 105-year average that I have is 17.5 inches. Based on my experience, if we get about 13 inches of rain, the Atascadero Basin is basically recharged. I see well levels come up to that 14 to 15 feet below the ground surface. And remember, we pull from both the alluvium and the Paso Robles formation. Mm-hmm. We try to pull the alluvial water first because if we don't pump that, it continues to flow north. Mm-hmm. Last year, that's primarily the water we served the community was from that alluvial source. So we're fortunate in that regard that we have those rights available to us.
Thank you.
I have a question for you regarding the Nacimiento water. I have been out to the lake and have noticed that the level is dropping at the lake. And I'm going to assume that that water could become limited for Atascadero in the future. Is that the case?
The county has what's called the master water contract with Monterey County. That master water contract gives San Luis Obispo County the first rights to the water that flows into that lake. So if any in any given year, if there's only 17,500 acre feet that flows into Nacimiento Lake, the county of San Luis Obispo gets that. There has never been a year since the dam was built that that level of inflow wasn't available. In addition, even though the Nacimiento Water Project right now is fully subscribed, most of the participants in that project are not using their full entitlements. So there's what they call surplus water available in the project. So from a reliability standpoint, it's pretty strong.
Very good. And from your perspective, is there anything that the city of Atascadero could do to help conserve more water?
I think going on what you're doing now, I mean, a lot of it's in the building code with low flow fixtures, those type of things. And a lot of it is in your landscape ordinance where you can only plant so much. So I think we're on the right track. I'm a little reluctant to say do more because my business is selling water. So, and that was a big issue a few years ago with that mandate. My revenue stream dropped by 25% also. So we want people to conserve. We want them to use it wisely. But we still want them to enjoy landscaping, those type of things.
Very good. Thank you. I'm going to open this to the public if there's anybody who would like to.
Mayor Pro Tem, I did have a question.
Sorry, Charles.
Prompted it was prompted by your question. You mentioned the 17,500 acre feet that the county is entitled to first. The water company, are the acre feet that you're signed up for comes out of that 17,500, correct?
Correct.
So that is to say, we as a recipient are part of that kind of first,
that's correct,
pot of guaranteed water.
Yeah, and if for some reason we don't get that type of inflow into the lake, all the participants' share drops proportionally.
Right, and right now, basically none of the participants are using their full allocation. So
that's correct.
We'd have a long way to go before that would become problematic. I think you've mentioned to me in the past that another cause of decreased per capita consumption of water is low-flow toilets and those kind of construction requirements and new construction, so that that's a big contributor to reduction.
Another thing I'm seeing is we have historically been a large lot subdivision, acre and a half. I think the average lot size is still an acre and a half. But the type of development we're seeing is the higher density projects. And they don't have the extensive landscaping you do on some of these larger parcels. So sure, our population is increasing and the number of lots that are developed is increasing, but what we're seeing is that high summer demand, which used to be 11 and 12 million gallons a day, I haven't seen it hit 9 million gallons in the last 5 years. So that high summer demand is really dropping off. Conversely, that winter demand is creeping up. It used to be about 2 million gallons a day in the winter. Now it's about 2.5, which you would expect. People still have to flush their commodes and take showers, et cetera. So you're going to sort of see those two things balance. And I always like to describe our contingency. If there is a water shortage, we know that half of the water we're producing is going on landscaping. If we cut that out, we can live purely on the water we get from Nacimiento Lake. That'll meet our needs, because it'll be to serve the needs of 31,000 people is about 2.5 million gallons a day. Well, that aquifer in Nacimiento can produce that, for a long time under really sustained drought conditions.
I just mentioned that because some of it, the conservation is not just mindful, some of it's structural because of the smaller lot sizes and kind of the low flow infrastructure that is required under the building code nowadays.
That's correct.
So long term, we will probably continue to see a decrease in per capita water usage. Thank you.
Seeing no other questions, I would like to open this to public comment. I realize this is a presentation is not normally open, but since this is of general interest, unless the city attorney tells me otherwise, I would like to open it up to public comment.
It's on the agenda, and public comment is certainly welcome.
Thank you. All right, John, we'll have you sit down, and you may have to get up again to answer some questions.
Hi, Susan Funk from Atascadero, and I thank the councilwoman and members of the council for the opportunity for public comment and question. And this is really a question directed to Mr. Neal. You mentioned a 105-year average rainfall, and I'm wondering what the dynamic modeling is if you look at more recent trends and the best data that we have now about where we are seeing trends towards increasing frequency of droughts and less stability in climate as we have rising CO2 levels in the atmosphere. And I'm wondering what those more dynamic models suggest in terms of the effect on drought in this community and the kinds of demands that we would have for water.
Thank you, Ms. Funk. We'll have the questions answered at the end of the public comment. Welcome.
Hi. Ellen Bayreau from Atascadero. And I have to say I was impressed with Atascadero and its ability to take away lawns. Like, we are probably one of the few cities in our county that does not have a lot of lawns, because I think we've made strides as citizens to conserve our energy, our water usage. My question for Mr. Neal is, I noticed that the water rates went up, which you have to because they have to survive, and we're a mutual water company, so we want them to survive. But I was just wondering if he got much pushback from that. I know sometimes citizens get upset when their rates go up. Personally, I use less water, and I pay about the same amount, and I'm okay with that. But I just was wondering financially how that works out for them. And I think it's great that we have the ability to use technology like low-flow equipment and keeping up with building codes to stay ahead of the curve on that. So that was my only question. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any other public comment? Seeing none, I'm going to close public comment and ask Mr. Neal to come to the podium again. Our first question was for Ms. Funk regarding the increasing frequency of drought and the effects.
I'm going to digress into my, I'm an engineer by trade, so I look at this data, these big blocks of data with rainfall, and I have 100 years of data, and it's broken up by month. And I know that the average is 17 and a half inches a year based on 105 years of data. If in any given year you take the deviation from that average, it's either above or below average, right? If you take the cumulative effect of that over a long period of time, you get to see very long-term trends in rainfall. So between 1913 and about 1948, we were in a wet period. So that cumulative deviation from average was positive. From 1948 to about 1980, we were in a very dry period. So that cumulative deviation was below the average. We've been in a wet period since about 1980 moving forward. What's interesting, it aligns itself with what's called, you see John Lindsay's weather reports, the Pacific Oscillation. It's a 40-year weather cycle. Well, it just seems to happen to follow that. I think with the fact that we're aware that it is a limited resource, that we have developed supplemental resources. We brought water into the basin from Nacimiento, and we're constantly working on trying to get people to conserve this product within reasonable limits without having big changes in their lifestyle. I think we can adapt readily. We have a pretty good cushion, like I explained earlier, between what it takes to have this community thrive, that 2.5 million gallons a day, and what our ability is to actually produce water in a sustainable fashion from the Atascadero Basin. I also think a lot of this is going to be really ground into when we get into the groundwater sustainability plan that is required under the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. We were able to cobble together a groundwater sustainability agency, which the city is a part of. We were able to get grant money to put this plan together. And collaboratively with the stakeholders in the Atascadero Basin, we're going to develop hopefully a very meaningful and useful sustainability plan. And it will address those type of things.
Thank you. Our second question is from Ms. Barreau regarding water rates that went up and the pushback that may have occurred.
First of all, we never raise water rates at the water. We only adjust them. And you've adjusted rates before. You do get pushback. Unfortunately, the pushback that we got was, in some ways, with the last rate increase, was somewhat artificially introduced because of the mandated conservation. That really, again, part of our rate structure is fixed, and the attempt there is to try to capture those fixed operation and maintenance costs. Well, it doesn't do that. The rest is captured in what's called a commodity charge. And when the sale of your commodity drops off precipitously, obviously your revenue stream drops off. It's pretty straightforward. Fortunately, just like the water use patterns, we have the lowest water rates in the county. For the amount of water that a customer uses in Atascadero, if you were in San Luis Obispo, that same amount of water would be $140 a month. Our average water bill is about $32 a month. So there's some flexibility there. I know it's not pleasant to get a rate increase, but our expenses are increasing. A good example, it's related to the Oroville Dam, believe it or not. The State Water Resource Control Board said, hey, dam operators, we need you to inspect your spillways. Mm-hmm. They're inspecting the Nacimiento Dam spillway and the Lake San Antonio spillway. There are some defects in those spillways that need to be addressed. Part of the master water agreement that the county has with Monterey is the county of San Luis Obispo picks up part of the cost of making those inspections and repairs. So my operating and maintenance costs for Nacimiento are going to go up next year by a fairly significant amount because of those required inspections and repairs that are anticipated. And then things like health insurance, all the typical things that go up. Electricity has been a big one for us. I mean, that's a third of our operating budget is just energy. So we're in the budget process now. I would anticipate, just looking at it, and I haven't finished it out, there may be a slight rate adjustment this year.
We're probably the first to hear it, so thank you. The fact that we're one of the lowest water rates in the county is really quite good, though. Thank you.
And I'm going to boast a little bit here. We operate the largest water system in the county. The Atascadero is a very big city. It's 35 square miles, mm-hmm. 240 miles of water main, plus all the appurtenances. If you compare that to the city of San Luis Obispo, I think they have 140 miles of water main. So it's just there's a lot of stuff out there, and there's a lot of topography that we have to deal with. So.
Okay. Thank you, John. We appreciate all that information. Very helpful.
You're welcome.
We're going to move on to our consent calendar, which is the draft action minutes of February 9th, 2018, and February 13th, 2018, and Title IX planning and zoning text amendments regarding downtown office and residential. Do I have a motion or a item pulled by the council? I'm going to have to open this to public, too, so. No one wanting to pull an item? Okay. Is there anyone in the public that would like to pull either of these items on the consent calendar? Seeing none, I'll close the public comment and bring it back to the council for a motion.
I'll move approval of the consent agenda.
Second.
Motion by Mr. Burbeau, second by Mr. Sturdivant. Let's have a roll call vote, please.
Councilmember Burbeau?
Yes.
Councilmember Sturdivant?
Yes.
Councilmember Moreno?
Yes, ma'am.
Mayor Pro Tem Fonsi?
Yes.
Motion passes.
Thank you, Laura. Our next is updates from the city manager, and she just left the room.
I'm going to fill in for our city manager. She's a little under the weather, felt that her voice might not be up to the task, and so I get the opportunity to talk to you a little bit about what's going on in the city. Only two items right now. The first has to do with what we are often fondly referred to as the new old City Hall. When we were over at the Creekside Building as our City Hall, we called this the old City Hall, and then we moved back in here, and now it became the new old City Hall. And so that building has, of course, been the subject of a lot of interest of late. The Creekside Building currently is in the process of being purchased from our redevelopment agency, the former redevelopment agency, by Colony Creekside LLC. It's in escrow. We're very excited about that. As soon as escrow closes, even more exciting news is that we have a tenant getting ready to move in right away. Chamber of Commerce is planning on leasing a good portion of the building. It will be house offices of the new Chamber Visitors Center and their office space that's currently kind of across the street on El Camino Real. So they're not moving far, but they are going to move to kind of a new home. The Chamber offers isn't going to be by itself. We're excited about them moving into a co-working space. The name of that space is going to be called Bridgework. Co-working is a little bit of a relatively new idea. Some people may not be familiar with it, but it's the idea that multiple users will come together and share a workspace, and then each of them has their own independent activity that they're engaged in, but they have a central location where they can conduct their own business. Typically, this type of workplace is attractive to those people who are involved in kind of work-at-home types of jobs, work-at-home professionals, independent contractors, business people who travel frequently but still need an office space to come and have meetings and do some of their work. The portion of the Creekside building that the chamber is looking at includes that space that's nearest to the new plaza, so really kind of a neat environment for them, a welcoming environment for members of the public to come visit them and for visitors to our community. They get to kind of showcase that newest, brightest piece there with our Centennial Plaza and the bridge. They're also planning, and we would invite not only council but members of the public to hold a press conference. The press conference will be Thursday morning, 10 a.m. They'll be making the official announcement about the move, and we are all planning to go out there and kind of cheer them on. We're looking forward to seeing what's coming to the new old City Hall. And then one more event that's coming we're also very excited about. I know Terry Banish has been working with the vendors, but we're looking forward to the Z-Day California Car Show that's going to be coming to Atascadero. This will be the second year that we've held this event here. It's going to be held in and around City Hall in the Sunken Gardens area. Last year we had hundreds and hundreds of people that came and walked around, got to see some of these cars, very elaborate cars put together very well by people who are very interested in this sort of thing. The event's going to be held this year on March 10th, Saturday, and will take place from 10 to 3 p.m., 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. We'll hold it rain or shine, although the way that they keep care of their cars, I wonder if it does rain, how many of them are going to be out there polishing and waxing and trying to keep their cars protected. This promises this year to be even bigger than last year. I know we've been working hand-in-hand with all the city departments and Terry to allow for an actual driving demonstration to take place on West Mall. We're looking forward to that. There's going to be a special guest appearance by one of the professional drivers in the Z-Car world, Chris Forsberg. He's going to be using a little portion of our roadway to kind of demonstrate that. We're pretty excited about it. We anticipate lots of vendors, food trucks, things to see and do, show models, music going to be taking place live. Racing simulators, I think last year they even had a mobile dyno testing thing where you could put your car on the rack and see how well it performed. So we are looking forward to this coming back, and we invite everyone from the public to come out and see it as well. That's, again, Saturday, March 10th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. And that does it for a city manager update.
Thank you for filling in, Chief. Are there any questions for the city manager or her stand-in? I did notice at the bottom of the Z-Day there was something called a race room. I'm assuming that isn't street racing in the middle of town or something, but just wondered if you could tell us what that is.
Yeah, so driving simulators that they brought in last year, I believe that's what that is, where you can actually come in and practice driving in a situation where the police aren't going to get involved. It's kind of neat. It gives you an opportunity to experience what it feels like to drive one of those Z-cars and drive it fast and make it maneuver in the way that they do without actually having to go through driver's training school to be able to do it or pay thousands upon thousands of dollars to get one of these cars yourself.
Wow, that sounds exciting.
Awesome.
Very good. Thank you. All right, I'm going to open it up now for a community forum. Anybody in the audience that would like to speak on any subject that is within the purview of our city council may speak. Please approach the podium. Well, we're a lively bunch tonight. Let's go ahead and close the public comment community forum. We'll move it on to public hearings, and we have none tonight, but we do have some management reports. The first is the informational presentation regarding local wildland fire threats and emergency planning, and this would be by our fire chief, Mr. Bryson. Casey?
Thank you, Council. I'm happy to bring a presentation tonight from the fire department. The topic tonight is our local wildland fire threat and emergency planning. We've had some questions over the last few months on where Atascadero is at and how we will do in the event of a large fire. And I think these were brought on by two major events that we had this last fall. First was the Tubbs Fire. That's the largest fire of several that occurred in Santa Rosa in October of this last year. The Tubbs Fire was 37,000 acres, over 5,000, almost 6,000 homes destroyed, but worst case right there was 43 fatalities. So that was a devastating, one of the most devastating fire, actually, that we've had in California, not in terms of acreage, but of homes lost and lives. So this started bringing up some questions. How is Atascadero prepared? We did have a strike team there. Captain Scott Hallett, one of our captains, led five engines to this fire. And I actually do have a little bit of footage. I'm just going to show a few seconds of this. This is him driving down one of these neighborhoods in Santa Rosa. So he had five engines from our county, Atascadero being one of them. They did some good work there. They stayed about 2 weeks and came home. This just gives an example of a fire that is completely different than what we expect. This is burning through cul-de-sacs, neighborhoods, home to home, and just totally very devastating. The next one was just a month or two later in December, actually, in the Ventura and Santa Barbara counties, we had the Thomas Fire. And this one, we had an engine there. I believe Scott Hallett was also the strike team leader. He had our engines from the county down there. And this one, the crews came home a couple days before Christmas. But this was a devastating fire in terms of the acreage, 280,000 acres on this one with over 1,000 structures. And unfortunately, two fatalities as well. One was a firefighter on this one. So that brought the questions from the public, the community, even council. How are we prepared? What are we going to do when this does happen? And we look at several different things. The first one is our fire history in Atascadero. And I realize this map may not be the easiest to see, but this is a fire history map that we have developed. And it really goes back, I believe, over 100 years, maybe 100 years or so. And you can see the outline of Atascadero in the black line. That big chunk in yellowish-orange is the Highway 41 fire. We have the Chispa to the bottom right-hand corner. Over the last few years, we've had a couple in town. We had this last year, we had about 15 acres near the golf course, a couple up in the Del Rio area, several on Pine Mountain over the last, it's probably been 10 or 15 years now, but that kind of gives a picture of our fire history. So we do have fires, or we have a history of fires. And it helps us, using a map like this, really helps us develop a picture of a historical perspective of where we have those hazards, where we have those threats, and what could potentially come. And that brings us to our fire hazard severity zones. So this is a map that that we use. This is actually on our city website, and you can get a better picture of it. And this identifies the high hazard areas in town. Not necessarily based on a historical perspective, but based on topography, predominant fuel typing, aspect of the terrain, access, and that sort of thing. So, and what we use this for is to help dictate building standards. So we know if we have a new home being built in those high or very high hazard severity zones, it is built to a different standard than it is built downtown. It also plays a part in our insurance, local insurance information that goes for your homeowner's insurance. So this is not necessarily based on where we've had fires in the past, but based on the threat due to those areas, based on their terrain and topography and that sort of thing. Areas in town, you can see it's our mostly west side, and then Pine Mountain, Chalk Mountain areas are in those high hazard areas. So those different building standards, if you were to build a house in these higher hazard areas versus in a downtown area, you have to build to an ignition-resistant construction type. So this mainly affects building openings, exterior doors and windows, even affects our road standards. So what you're trying to do is make sure your home is protected in a couple ways. The radiant heat aspect, so impact of a wall of flame, basically. You're making that building resistant to that heat factor. That's your glazed windows, your rated doors, your type one or your highest protected roof covering and siding, all that sort of thing. And also, we're worried about the Ember cast. So the other thing that these building construction standards apply to is keeping all your openings in your house protected. Ember screens on vent openings. It's walls underneath porches, not letting any of that ember cast when that wind blows through. It carries those embers through. If those get lodged in some area underneath a deck or a porch or in the attic venting, the fire can start in the structure well after the flame front has passed. So those two areas are what we try to build these houses to with the building standards. And that's so that's one piece of it. That's one way we deal with it. We also we talk about pre-fire planning. And when we're looking at pre-fire planning, we're talking mostly about fuel reduction. So we have three main ways we try to get rid of the fuels. And the goal here is to create a defensible space. We call it defensible space around your house that firefighters can get in. We could bring an engine into that's safe, to protect. We can defend the house, and it gives us a chance. It gives us the time, actually, to get to the house, too. So chipping, by far, is one of our best avenues here. We receive grants almost every year. We haven't for a year or two, but from the local county, Silence County Fire Safe Council. This year we have a grant. We've sent the mailers out. We're going to be targeting those high hazard areas on the west side first. So that's where we're making our effort. But anything that's down trees, so this is good for those bigger fuels, the trees that have come down over the winter, the larger limbs that don't really work for backyard burning, or if you have trouble getting them into a green waste bucket, get them to the side of the road. First, you got to get on our list, right, so we know to come. But then we'll get those chipped up, and that's by far one of the best programs. Backyard burning is on there. It's hopefully this is your last resort. It's not designed for downtown. It's not for small lots. It's one way to reduce our fuel, but it has to be done right, and you have to follow all the rules we have. We said if it will be a burn day every morning at 8 in the morning, you have to follow quite a list of rules to make sure this is done safely and with the intent of reducing fuel, but also keeping smoke to a manageable level and not choking our neighbors out and that sort of thing. So backyard burning should be done after chipping and after stuffing whatever you can in your green waste bin. And then finally, weed abatement is mandatory for all of us. June 1st is that deadline. And that really creates that 100-foot defensible space around the structure. With the intent there is more the annual grasses. That's not the bigger fuels, but it's to keep those annual grasses down and give us that chance to get in there. So the next part then behind fuel reduction is our public education. And we need an ongoing, persistent public outreach to continue the fire safety message. Last year we had our first open house in years at Fire Station 1. And we did it to coincide with Wildfire Community Preparedness Day. We intend to do that again on May 5th. So we were able to engage, I think, about 500 people from the community on all aspects of fire safety, but primarily on getting that house prepared. Your house may have not been built to those standards, but there's things you can do to harden it. Harden that structure is how we say it. Replace windows, close up the eaves, remove the wood piles away from the house. And we spend quite a bit of time with people at that event last year and hope to do the same this year and really educate on what can be done. We follow the guidelines from Ready, Set, Go. This is a program from the International Association of Fire Chiefs. And it really is a good way to describe how we ask people to be prepared. The ready part is kind of the personal responsibility ahead of time, defending the house, having that defensible space cleared, doing the things to your house to make sure it's resistant as possible, having emergency supplies on hand, knowing your escape routes and that sort of thing. So being ready ahead of time. The set part is being ready to go, having your valuables all gathered. And a big part of this is knowing how to receive information, how to get information, knowing, the social media from either the city, the county, the news outlets, either through Facebook or Twitter or Instagram. There's a lot of information that gets passed on, and you need to know how to get a hold of that. The next one that I'll skip ahead just a quickly as that public service announcement is one of the last ones that we sent out, and we try to do this regularly from the fire department, but was really telling people or reminding people how to be alerted by the sheriff's office. They have the program so your cell phone can be contacted during an evacuation time and not just your landline. A lot of people don't have landlines anymore, their home phone, or in the event of a power outage, your landline may not work, especially if you're the voice over IP and that sort of thing. So having those cell phones registered is key. So let me jump back quick to go. Go is that last point under Ready, Set, Go. And it's just knowing the plan. It's getting out when it's time to go, knowing what's going on, getting out quickly so and safely so you're safe and fire can get in. That last point there, resident consultation, we do this all the time. We're always happy to meet up with people, whether it's myself or fire marshal or an engine company. We're happy to talk about your house, what you can do, weed abatement, where we talk a lot of people about their burn pile, if it is illegal or not, if it needs to be reduced in size. So we're always can always contact anyone at the fire station, and we'll make an appointment to make sure your house is well protected. This goes back to that Ready, Set, Go, knowing your evacuation route. This is just a picture that we have on our city website of the map of evacuation routes. And the important thing here is to know where you're at, but to know to have multiple ways. This, you have to know these routes, but you also have to be flexible. We don't know where the fire is going to come from or which evacuation route will be open or which one will be closed. So we all know Atascadero streets on our west side can be confusing, and having multiple ways out and how to get out is key right there. So finally, the kind of the next piece is fire response. And as a new chief, safety is definitely my primary motive here for both the public, but also my staff. So training is key here for wildland firefighting. We have annual wildland refreshers. We have daily engine company training. We have physical fitness ongoing daily. Daily situational awareness. We know the staff is expected to know what's going on throughout the state in the fire environment at any given time, knowing if resources are moving north or south or what the weather's supposed to be. So we stay very, very in tune with what's going on. We also train for simulated fires in different areas. We have large maps. We have probably a 10 by 10 on the station wall. It's an aerial photograph of the entire city. And we plot fires in different locations, and our captains have fought on a large map on the wall. We've fought fires all over town, looking at what resources we would need and how we would tackle that and how we would confine that to different areas of town. So we use maps in all different cases, but that's one where, and we have those on all of our engines as well. The next point, mutual aid, is we can't do this alone. We have good partners with the county, CAL FIRE, the county of San Luis Obispo, Paso Robles, Templeton State Hospital. And we're staffed well for daily response, but we're not staffed for one of these types of incidents. And we have what we call a mutual threat zone with the county. So they treat a fire in our west side as if it's a threat, which it is, to their area, and as if respond to it accordingly, like it's one of their fires. So right off the bat, we'll have aircraft, we'll have hand crews, we'll have bulldozers, all responding into a fire on the west side, and we definitely have to rely on our neighbors for that kind of help. The last point I have is on city emergency preparedness. The fire department is tasked with keeping the emergency plan up to date, training staff, and being ready to respond and operate the Emergency Operations Center. So this is kind of an ongoing process. It's kind of cyclical in nature that we start with, kind of the end process was the city staff went back to the Emergency Management Institute on the East Coast probably 14 months ago, and that was a full drill to test us. And now we kind of come back and we know what training we need to work on. So we're actually in the process right now of training each department by department, giving some additional information there. And then that leads to tabletop exercise we'll have this spring or this fall. And then in the wintertime, we'll have a full-scale drill, which is the plan. So it's we're working on it. We're all disaster workers. I realize all city employees will need to come back and help mitigate, you know, the type of disaster in town. Realizing the fire department responds on these more so than the rest of the city staff, so we have to keep that training going and keep everybody up to date and in the loop. So just in closing, just want to say that you have a well-trained, well-equipped fire department. We're ready, although this is quite the event, these two that brought the questions on. And we know we live in the fire environment. We're all here in Atascadero, and we have this potential. But we are well prepared, and we'll keep looking to the future to engage the community and make progress where we can. So with that, I'll turn it over for any questions.
Thank you, Chief. Good presentation. Any questions? Councilmember Sturdivant, I saw you first, then Councilmember Barreau.
Something I heard from about the fire down in Ventura was that there was a large amount of fuel vegetation or fuel management that had not been, you know, kept up with, or it was allowed to build. There was allowed to be a lot of fuel there for that fire. So, do we as a city have a plan for fuel management, or just the hills, the valleys we have, things that are dead? Do we go through and do any kind of preparation and to reduce that load?
Yeah, for sure. A lot of it is our weed abatement program. When we do those inspections, we are looking for down fuels on people's property, and we'll address those at that time. But we also are looking for areas either right on the edge of town or neighboring the city limits where we can put in fuel breaks. We have one that we put in, kind of went along Eagle Ranch on the top of Los Osos, on the edge of the city right there. We've also put in some shaded fuel breaks in the bowl here in town, Pine Mountain. So we are looking at those areas, and we work with CAL FIRE. I think working with CAL FIRE to get those projects done, I think we'll have more opportunities for that. I think there's going to be more money available from the Fire Safe Council that we can apply for grants, and we'll continue to look for those areas where we can put in fuel breaks.
Thank you.
Councilmember Barreau.
Yes, thank you. Chief, you know, these last two big fire events in Santa Rosa and down south are really kind of scary to see what they could do, burning through whole neighborhoods or hundreds of homes before you can get resources there. As you indicated, we have a small department. You can't fight that kind of fire without a lot of outside resources. So, you know, and it seems to me that those things happen because it was just, you know, too hot, too windy, you know, just blows through too fast before anybody can get some resources there to fight it. What would you see, if anything, that you can do differently? What have you guys learned that you're going to say how we would approach this differently? Or are we really simply at the mercy of if a fire starts and it's hot and windy and very, very dry, that it has the potential to do here what it did on the Thomas, you know, early part of the Thomas fire?
So a couple of things. The Tubbs fire, that fire moved at 70, it was being pushed by 70 plus mile an hour winds. There's really not a whole lot you can do. Those firefighters just kept backing up, and they were trying to make stands in, you know, Walmart parking lots and lost commercial buildings. At that point, until that wind stops, there's not a whole lot you can do. From our perspective, from where we're located in town, we realize we're going to have a several-minute drive to many of these parts of town. And a couple things. We're going to rely on aircraft. We can get aircraft out of Paso Robles Air Base very quickly. But really, what it comes down to, I think, is until we get there, if the fire can stay as small as possible, that's the best. That's our best option, you know, because we don't have the ability to keep resources out there to get closer. So the more we stress weed abatement, defensible space, basically what those weed abatement sections do, if you keep those breaks going, it's going to slow down every time it hits that fire break, basically, in essence. It's just going to give us that time to get that, you know, it could be several minutes before we get out there. And, yeah, it kind of is what it is. I don't expect the kind of fire behavior necessarily that some of those saw. We don't necessarily have the sundowners in Santa Barbara for a couple of reasons, I think. We don't have those ongoing winds, but...
Interesting point that, you know, those were driven by extremely high winds, and I don't know what in the dry season, which, of course, now that could be most of the year, I guess, what our highest winds are that we typically experience. But I guess what I'm wondering is, you know, to be realistic for our citizens, you know, we very much, like those places, could have a fire, I suppose, that is, you know, until the wind dies down, you're kind of at its mercy, in which case it really becomes an evacuation issue. And are you, you know, you've got the evacuation maps and everything, and I'm not sure how well understood those are by members of the public, but are you satisfied that should an event like this occur, let's say with, you know, 40-mile-an-hour winds, are our evacuation routes, you know, adequate, or do we run the risk of people being trapped?
It's going to be an event for sure if we're trying to evacuate a large section of the west side. I think my first point about knowing multiple ways out and doing our best to get people that information where they can go and which side of town. But really, you look at our city, the size of it, getting our police officers out there to assist us with those evacuations, it's going to be trying. They're going to be calling in extra resources, sheriffs, for help. But we're going to get, you know, we're going to do what we can. We've talked about the possibility of doing a drill of a small section of the west side and see what it, see how quickly we can move people in a certain amount of time, and that may be something we look at here shortly.
Right. I'm, you know, perfectly confident that the, you know, both departments do everything they can and be very professional about it, but, you know, our citizens have to realize to some degree they have a personal responsibility to understand, know a route of evacuation and know how they're going to get out, and, you know, and not then, you know, blame the city for not there and making a miracle happen. So I'm just concerned that our citizens, anything we can do to educate them proactively, I guess. So anyway, thank you. Very good presentation.
Councilmember Moreno.
So, Chief, what have we done, maybe just to help answer that question, to inform people of those evacuation routes and what are the resources available? So that, you know, I would assume that if you live out on the west side, you're thinking, hey, this is a possibility, and I need to get some information, but maybe not everybody has. So what are the ways that we can get in touch with people, and what are the ways people out there who want the information can get it?
People can look it up on our city website, so it's located there. We have plenty of them that we give out at the fire station. We did include information in our chipping mailer, and we'll continue to do that. I think with our weed abatement mailer, we may have some information in there as well. And then it's, you know, the public service announcements. We're trying to stay current on whether it's weed abatement or whether it's chipping or whether it's the reverse 911 sort of thing. But keep the message going, engaging people as we can through that, either the social media or the announcements. And then it's going to be our contact with them, hopefully through our open house, as we're out doing weed abatement inspections, those consultation type things. As much contact as we can with the public, we're going to keep telling our message and trying to teach as much as we can.
Now, do residents need to sign up for reverse 911, or is that automatic that we have the numbers of all the residents that we would need?
Yeah, our point a month or so ago was to get your cell phone listed, and I believe landlines are going to be just fine, but it's the cell phones. If the power goes out or if you don't have a landline anymore, those are the ones you actually need to go on the sheriff's website and get that listed.
Okay, so if someone in town has a landline, they're already included in reverse 911, but if they only use a cell phone or they want to include their cell phone, then they would go online to the county, to the sheriff's department, and get listed for reverse 911. Is that,
that's
am I
correct.
Understanding that? Okay. My other question is, I think you said that there was going to be another type of a drill this fall. Is that sort of citywide? Is that just with emergency services? Will you be including other folks from the county who participated with us at EMI? What will that entail?
So it's kind of in the initial stages of being planned with the police department. We're looking to do a tabletop, which would be just the key players in the EOC at that point, and that would be this spring or this fall. We haven't finalized a date yet. The next one would be kind of a boots-on-the-ground type drill, more of a full-scale one, which would be either the winter time or next after the first of the year, and that one would involve those players that we took to EMI with us, as many as we can.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you.
Councilmember Sturdivant?
In communities, there's some communities in the United States I've seen where they have like hurricanes, tornadoes, those type of things. They have evacuation on the main routes. They actually have signage that gets people thinking. Because I know when I was driving down the road, all of a sudden I saw the sign. I thought, uh-oh, I mean, we have that happening here. So, but it gave me the idea of, oh, this is where I can need to be to get out. And I was wondering, do we have any, on the main routes from the west side, do we have any signage? Do we have anything that denotes the main arterial the evacuation routes the preferred routes on the west side?
I don't believe we have anything that's actually posted out on the streets right now, and that's definitely something we can look into. I think it's good. It would definitely give people to show them one way out. However, things can be so fluid in this kind of environment. I'd hate for that to be the only way that they know how to get out, but it's definitely, I think, having some signage and some markings could be a good thing.
I think just awareness sometimes mm-hmm. can get people to start thinking, so thank you.
Other questions? Yes, Councilmember Moreno?
Just when Councilmember Stern brought that up, it reminds me, I remember us talking about this a couple of years ago and just wondering about maybe even a liability issue with saying, hey, this way out, if at that time that route happens to not be available. So I'm sure there's something we need to be doing, and you probably are doing it, and maybe a bigger discussion. I also know that most of us, wherever we live, we know multiple routes in and out because of traffic or different things that happen. So most folks probably do that naturally, but it's in the moment where probably the reverse 911 and something like that is letting them know that, hey, that route you might be tempted to go, and even if there was a sign out there, that could be sending someone in the wrong direction. So,
a couple of questions since we have none others from the council members. I know that along the freeway there are signs that say that it's a high fire hazard day, and I think we have that in front of our local fire stations, don't we? Is that something that we need to do, or we've already got it?
We do. We
I
have
thought
those.
So. Yeah. Yeah.
They have changeable faces on them, so they do get put up high fire danger during the summer or announcements, so depending on the season.
Very good. And I you talked a bit about getting rid of fuel, and we've had droughts, and trees have died, and there's been chaparral that's dead, and other issues. Let's say a landowner, property owner, had a dead oak tree. Would that be appropriate to call the fire department, or this is something they should get removed with their own tree removal company?
Depends on the size. I believe the chipping size, it'll take pretty good-sized limbs. And if it's something that can be dragged close to the road, that would be something that we could take care of. If it's a full-size tree, something larger, we don't really have the resources to get that. We would definitely come out and consult, though, and see if we can give you some options on how to get rid of that.
And so the chipper would actually do chaparral if somebody went out and whacked it off and drug it up. You could take care of that.
Yes.
Yep. Okay, very good. And just a question. I know that we're doing some improvements on the bridge on Santa Lucia Road, which is a long road and it's a dead end. Is that this year, and do we need to talk about changing evacuation routes because of that bridge being renovated and rerouted?
I might have to defer on the actual timing of the bridge. The evacuation route, I don't think will have to be changed, but I'll have to look at that.
Okay, very good. All right, I'm going to open it up to the public. Is there anybody who has questions for Fire Chief? Well, let's go to Nick before I open it. Do you have anything that you could tell us about the Santa Lucia Bridge, and then we'll open?
Sure. We're currently in design for that bridge. We've talked a lot about staging because this is kind of a one-way out. And currently what we're looking at, there's a few options for, because the bridge, we could do it half and half and have half the bridge open. that's going to be more costly to do that. It'll drag out the project for a couple more months. Currently, we're the front-running option is to tear the bridge down, have a one-lane temporary bridge next to it. So there'll still be access in and out of the area. There's also that Yonel Bridge that's at, it's kind of an older wooden bridge that's kind of fell in low disrepair. We're looking at that as well to be able to get the, as an option to get folks out from the Yano area. There's also Balboa Road, which is a little rough. It's not a maintained road, yeah. But there's also some other options for alternative ways to get out.
And that's going to be done this year, correct? Or
I'm trying to think. I think it's next summer is when we're looking at
it. So we have a little time to plan for this then.
We have a little more time, and we'll be bringing an update to the council sometime, probably by midsummer, as far as, like, you know, revised plans and just giving you an update on that project and the Via Bridge as well.
Thank you, Mr. DeBar. Sure. Okay, let's go ahead and open it up to the public. Welcome.
Ellen Burrow again. And I just wanted to congratulate the fire department for getting that grant again for the chipping program. I live on the west side on Laurel Road, and I'm a huge fan of it. We pull stuff, tons of stuff to the street. And I do think it makes a big difference because the stuff I pull out, most of it's dead. I mean, we put a trail on our property, so we drug out that stuff too. But please take advantage of that if you have any wild area on your property, because there's always dead stuff that can be pulled out. And I did have a consultation with a retired fireman, and he looked at my house completely differently than I looked at my house in terms of fire danger. So it does make a big difference to have someone who kind of knows wind patterns and, you know, if you get a fire, it's going to come from here. And I was like, really? I never thought of that. And, you know, and I've been worried about fires since I lived there, which is, you know, more than 10 years. So it really does help to get the perspective of the firemen who deal with fire in real time versus us looking at it on TV. And I know one thing we're doing, and I don't know if the fire department provides resources, is we're putting in different vents to our attic. After seeing all the Ember fires in Ventura, we were totally freaked out. And you can get kinds that actually will close. It's like a honeycomb. It'll close, so the embers cannot get in at all. Like, I have a standard house that has, like, concrete siding and all that kind of stuff. But I just have the regular mesh. That's like a quarter inch. Embers can get in there easy. I would have been one of those casualties that you saw on TV. So there are things you can do to upgrade your house. We got rid of a wood deck. We now have a patio. I feel much safer. So there are things you can do. And a lot of our homes are older, you know, built in the 80s. And they could really benefit from some additional investment. So thank you again for getting the chipping program. My piles are growing already. So I can't wait. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Hi, thank you. Susan Funk from Atascadero. And first, I want to thank the chief and the fire department for the service of our folks in the Tubbs fire and in the Thomas fire. We were all following that and rooting for our guys to come home safe and to do the amazing work that they have done. And we want to thank you for that and recognize that service. Also, you mentioned that the Sheriff's Department website, is there a phone number for our residents who are not particularly adept with their computers? Some of us get our thumbs not so nice as years go by, or don't have ready access to computers. Is there a website, or is there a phone number that they can call to get their cell phone registered that you could announce now on this publicly aired program for the benefit of those folks?
We'll get to that at the end of public comment.
Okay,
thank you, though.
We'll do that. Okay, and likewise, if you have the specific web address for the sheriffs, if that could be announced on this program for the benefit of folks who might catch up with this on cable television at some point, and take a moment to get their phones registered so that we can keep our community safe. And then my other question and concern, one of the things that we all learned from watching that terrible process in the Tubbs and Thomas fires was the risk of those terribly high winds combining with power lines. So I was wondering if the chief could address where we have power lines in the area that might be at particular risk, and are there steps that we can take to make this community safer in situations where the wind might kick up and put risk of, you know, sparks flying that create an event that can get started before you can get out there to respond. So I would appreciate hearing from the chief on that as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that would like to speak on this subject? Seeing none, I'll close it and bring it back to our fire chief to answer the questions regarding the sheriff phone number and perhaps a website for those who are not as savvy with their computer so they can get their reverse 911 information.
Okay, I do have the press release that was sent out, and we'll just go ahead and get that out again. How's that? But for now, I have... Oh, it's our phone number. I don't have it right off the top of my head. We will get this out again tomorrow, unless someone else has a way to get it out real quick.
I've got it, Casey.
Laura has it. Go ahead.
It's slowsheriff.onthealert.com, and that's the website for to register for the reverse 911. They don't actually give a phone number for that. Everything seems to require that you do it online. So
I would recommend that you contact the Sheriff's Department non-emergency dispatch line at area code 805-781-4550. Let them know that you don't have computer access and see if they can help you with that registration through their dispatch line.
Very good. Thank you. And there was another question. This was regarding winds and power lines in Atascadero.
So this is definitely the problem that happened in Santa Rosa that contributed to several of those fires. And we're talking 70-mile-an-hour winds, sustained. And I don't know what the gusts were, but it definitely took down power lines and caused several of those fires. Again, we typically don't have those conditions here. I'm not saying that we can't, but we typically don't. There has been discussion, I think, with what can be done moving on in the future. What is the potential of putting, you know, what can be put underground and what can't? I have a feeling that terrain in Atascadero is going to make that not real conducive to having that happen immediately. And we do have the high tension lines, the high power lines running across the west side from kind of that northern point there. And those definitely stand up. That's a well-built system, so that stands up to the higher winds. So we're talking about more of our smaller lines. I think there will be plans. I think we'll look at that in the future, but I don't know if they have a plan with PG&E right at the moment. There is also some discussion on shutting them down, you know, in the event before the fires start. We're expecting winds. At what point can we basically cause a blackout kind of thing to prevent that? So I think we'll hear more about that. And I don't have information yet on when they'll get to that, but I think that'll be in our future.
Very good. Okay, before I close this, I'd like to give that website out again for the sheriff. It's slowsheriff.onthealert.com. And the phone number to call is 805-781-4550. Thank you very much, Casey. That was helpful.
And Mayor Pro Tem, if I just may make one more reminder. If you have a voice over IP landline, yes, you also need to register that. And you also need to be aware and reminded that those do not work during a power outage. And I met somebody from Santa Rosa who had that difficulty. And so I want to make sure that, to remind people, please register your voice over IP. You are not automatically in the landline reverse 911 system. And to also register your cell phone so that you have a backup in the event of a power loss.
Very good. So when in doubt, go ahead and register, it sounds like, with your phone number. All right. I'm back with the council, and I need a motion to receive and file.
Move. Receive and file.
Second.
Motion by Councilmember Morano, second by Councilmember Sturdivant. Roll call vote, please.
Councilmember Moreno?
Yes, ma'am.
Councilmember Sturdivant?
Yes.
Councilmember Burbo?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie?
Yes.
Motion passes.
Thank you, Laura. Okay, our next management report is a resolution in support of the Reducing Crime and Keeping California Safe Act of 2018. And this will be Police Chief Gerald Haley making the presentation.
Thank you, Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie and Council. I appreciate the opportunity. I see Luke over there glaring intently at his computer screen, so he's going to try and bring up our presentation. And there it is. Thank you, Luke. Tonight we're asking the Council to consider passing a resolution in support of a measure that's being proposed for 2018, named the Reducing Crime and Keeping California Safe Act of 2018. My job tonight is to provide you with a little bit of information on what led to this piece of legislation and answer your questions concerning my support of it and recommended support of the council. I wanted to provide you with a little bit of an overview on why we're here. Over the course of about the last 4 years, council knows I've brought information forward about a number of pieces of legislation that have been passed at the state level, mostly designed at the reduction of the prison population, state prisons. We're experiencing some overcrowding, and there was a movement on the part of the governor and others to reduce the number of people being housed at the state level and push some of that back down to local communities. There were also some measures designed at reducing or, in some cases, eliminating the criminal prosecution for certain crimes, certain conduct that had previously been deemed to be criminal in nature. There was a movement at the time to kind of decriminalize some of those. And the three pieces of legislation that you're most familiar with would be AB 109, which is also known as the Prison Realignment Act, Proposition 47, which, to my opinion, was kind of fraudulently named the Safe Neighborhoods and Schools Act. I don't believe that that accurately represents what that proposition was all about. And then most recently, Prop 57, again, somewhat deceitfully named the Public Safety and Rehabilitation Act. Those are the three that you're most familiar with and the three that have had the largest impact on law enforcement and our communities. The effects of these measures have kind of caused what we would consider unintended consequences. I won't begin to propose that anyone knew that these things were going to happen when they passed those measures, but there has been a net effect, especially to law enforcement, of these measures being passed. And some of those that have hit us locally here include things like the increase of property theft crimes. I've mentioned to council previously that we have seen in some areas of our county double-digit increases in property theft crimes within the span of 1 year after the passage of Proposition 47. That trend has continued. We're starting to see it not only in this county, but we've seen it statewide, where the level of increases have been in double digits, where in all of the years previous, going back in some cases 30 years, the trending was always downward in terms of our property theft crimes and other crimes. It's not just property theft. We are seeing increases in violent crimes and other crimes, but that's where it's been most noticeable, is in property theft crimes. We're also starting to see that we're getting fewer, I use the term hits, that's a jargon term. What I mean is positive identifications from evidence related to DNA. So there is a DNA database that we use when we get evidence to submit our evidence against and determine if we can identify a suspect, much like fingerprints. In our case, in the state of California, there were a number of persons who previously would have been swabbed or gotten a DNA sample taken from them, and that number has been reduced. And so we've seen a direct correlation between the reduction in the number of samples that we're taking and the number of actual positive hits that we're getting from this DNA evidence. And that results in fewer people getting prosecuted for the crimes that they're committing when they're out on our streets. And then finally, we're seeing locally that law enforcement is being forced to deal with not only more violent offenders, but habitual offenders, repeat offenders on a more regular basis. The sheriff at county jail has been inundated with more people being housed there at his facility that often whom would have been at the state level. And then we are seeing more people being released because of that, because of overcrowding in local jails, and we're seeing more people out on the street than we would have seen in previous years. So we are being called upon to deal more and more with these consistent offenders. There's even some anecdotal information that would say we're starting to see some increases in the number of people who are habitually transient as a result of the fact that oftentimes those individuals would have been incarcerated previously and they're not any longer. And so there's still some work to be done to determine if those numbers correlate to some of these measures being passed. But if you've watched the news recently, you've seen the impacts being documented in cities like San Francisco, Orange County, Los Angeles, where the numbers of habitually transient individuals are skyrocketing. They're dealing with a large number of problems as a result of it. The types of legislation that we're proposing would help us to deal with some of these impacts and, in some cases, potentially eliminate some of those impacts. And so kind of what this legislation is trying to do is reverse some of these unintended consequences without subverting the will of the voters. And I think that the writers of this legislation have done a really good job of that. And we're not trying to rewrite history. In one instance, crimes that used to be felonies have been made into misdemeanors. The writers of this piece of legislation are not trying to rewrite that and make them back into felonies. We're simply trying to deal with the unintended consequences of turning those felonies into misdemeanors. And there are four really primary areas where this legislation seeks to, as I say it, right the wrong. Unintended or intended matters not. It's still something that's affecting us, and we want to reverse that trend and right the wrong. The first one is one that I feel probably most strongly about, and this is something that Proposition 57 really had an impact in. Proposition 57 changed the list of what we consider violent crimes for which people could not be released early from prison. And it eliminated a number of previously violent crimes so that people who are now early or eligible for early release include people convicted of trafficking a child, felony domestic violence, assault on a peace officer, rape of an intoxicated person. None of those sound nonviolent to me. And so part of the reason that this law was written is to kind of rewrite a couple of those that accidentally got put into that piece of legislation, to rewrite them back into the violent category. Because I think, again, anytime we're talking about sexual assault of a child or rape, whether it's through intoxication or any other means, certainly that is something that we would deem as violent. And in those cases, I think that those people should not be eligible for early release from prison, that they should have to serve more of their time as required by law for other violent crimes. The second one is to kind of assist with that problem of certain people not having DNA collection done. Prior to the passage of Proposition 47, we were able to collect DNA on people responsible for committing felony drug-related crimes. Part of the reason that collection is so important is we know that people who are addicted to narcotics are often involved in property theft types of crimes as a means of supporting their habit. And so as we go through the process of collecting evidence and DNA evidence at residential burglaries or vehicle break-ins, things of that nature, we would often get those what I call hits, the positive identification of suspects responsible for committing those crimes
through the use of this DNA collection when they were arrested for a felony drug violation. And so because of a drug arrest, we were able to prevent further property crimes from occurring. What this law hopes to do is kind of restore the DNA collection for some of the individuals who are now going to be convicted of misdemeanors. It doesn't change that back to felonies. It leaves it as a misdemeanor, but it allows for the court-mandated collection of that DNA evidence from those individuals for certain crimes, such as drug possession, that previously had been listed as a felony. A third one, and one that we are seeing throughout the state, has to do with decrease in the number of people being arrested for felony theft violations. And so it used to be that if you, way back in the day when I started in law enforcement, if you stole more than $400 of some item, you were convicted of a felony. That threshold has now been increased over the course of years and through most recent legislation to $950. And individuals responsible for stealing up to $950 can only be convicted of a misdemeanor. And what we're seeing throughout the state is what we call serial thefts taking place, where I can go in and I can commit theft after theft after theft after theft. As long as I don't steal more than $950, I'm okay. I'm never going to face any kind of felony charge for it. And so the legislation seeks to change that so that we don't have these kind of serial robbers, serial burglars, serial thieves engaging in this kind of conduct. And so with the passing of this legislation, if you're convicted of three or more offenses of theft, serial, what we would call serial theft now, of over $200, $250, I think, that then would become a felony offense, so that we wouldn't have these people who are habitually committing just under $950 worth of theft and getting away with it. And then the fourth kind of major provision is this, that currently with the passage of certain pieces of legislation, the parole board is only allowed to consider the most recent offense when determining whether someone is eligible for release on parole. And in a most egregious example, somebody who had been convicted of multiple prior rapes, when he goes before the parole board, those prior incidents can't be considered when they are determining whether to release somebody on parole for a fresh rape, for a new rape. And so in many cases, we're finding that people are being released despite the fact that they have a long criminal history and are not really some of that we should consider eligible for parole. And so this law seeks to change that, to allow the parole board and actually require the parole board to consider the totality of someone's criminal history before making them eligible for release. So if somebody does have numerous prior offenses, especially some of these egregious felonious assaults, that the parole board can not only consider it, but is required to consider it in determining whether that person should be released or not. Again, those are the major provisions. I think you have some in your packet, some written examples of the legislation as it's to be passed. The reason that I'm here is because this was brought to our attention through the California Police Chiefs Association. They were responsible in helping myself and other chiefs of police draft the resolution language that you have before you. What we're trying to do is show that this is a statewide effort, that it's not just the little city of Atascadero that's trying to seek to right the wrongs of some of these pieces of legislation, but that there is truly a statewide effort on the parts of police departments to really go back and look at what we passed and why we passed it and see that there's some of these provisions that just need to be corrected so that we can live in a safe community. And so California Police Chiefs Association has asked chiefs of police throughout the state to participate along with them in seeking these resolutions. I know myself personally, I mentioned local law enforcement up there, I met with the members of the Criminal Justice Administrators Association of San Luis Obispo County, and there was some unanimity on the part of the chiefs of police in this county that they would go forward and seek these resolutions on behalf of our communities to right some of these wrongs. In addition to local law enforcement, our own District Attorney Dan Dow is here, and part of the reason he's here is because this is near and dear to his own heart. The District Attorneys Association throughout the state, DAs have come forward in support of this piece of legislation and are promoting its passage, and our own DA has decided to kind of take the lead in that. And so he is, I think he just got back from Sacramento today. I don't know if that's what he was there for, but he is going throughout the state promoting this act and hoping to ensure its passage. For me, I would call it common sense that, you know, certainly there are times when we pass pieces of legislation and we have great intent, and as voters, we're doing the best we can, and then down the line, we look back and say, okay, some part of this didn't work. And I think this is a limited effort. It's limited in scope, but it does cure some of those most egregious instances of a piece of legislation that just needs a little tune-up. And so I am hopeful that the council will consider passing the resolution. I know that I've been asked by our fellow chiefs of police to provide them with some feedback after tonight to allow them to move forward as well. I am happy to answer any questions you have about this, and I know that DA Dow is here for the express purpose of potentially speaking in favor of the passage of this and answering questions as well if there's something that I can't.
Very good. Thank you, Chief. Very interesting. And just a clarification before I give it to the council for their questions. This is asking the council to pass a resolution that will go up to Sacramento to support passage of legislation that's actively being considered.
That's correct.
Thank you. And this would be for the city attorney. Would it be appropriate to have Mr. Dow, our DA, speak on this before we open it up for questions so we could address both, or should we do this separately?
That would be at your discretion. So you could do either way.
Very good. I think I'd like to have Mr. Dow come up and give his portion of this same presentation on this subject, and then we'll go to council questions.
Thank you, Madam Mayor Pro Tem and members of the council. It's good to be here this evening. Chief Haley did an excellent job of kind of setting forth the four goals of this proposition. I just want to clarify it. It's not going to be voted on in Sacramento, but it will be if we are successful in collecting 600,000 signatures between now and April, sometime in April, then it will be on the ballot for November for voters of California to approve that or have a chance at least to do so. So I just want to reiterate some of what Chief Haley said. We've had tremendous changes to our California legal system in terms of criminal justice and how we approach crime since 2011. And the Chief gave a great rundown of those changes. The most recent being Prop 57 passed in 2016. That was a proposition that we, the voters, passed. And the way it was described to the voters was that it was an early release program where nonviolent offenders currently in state prison would be allowed to get a chance to get out early. The problem with that is that what has been defined as violent is limited in the penal code to just some of the most serious offenses. And so when we, the voters, heard nonviolent, most people thought it was the thieves, it was the drug addicts, those that are truly not committing a violent offense. But if you look at what happened in 2011, realignment actually, in the Sacramento legislators passed realignment. It took all of what they called the non-non-nons, the non-violent, non-sex offender, and non-serious offenders out of state prison and said they're only eligible to be sentenced to county jail. So that left, after 2011, in state prison, only the violent, serious, and sex offenders. So because the penal code only has a small list of offenses that are described as violent, everything that's not on there but is still sexual or serious in state prison was now considered nonviolent and eligible for early parole. So some of those specific offenses are human trafficking of a child for commercial sexual exploitation, abducting a minor for prostitution, rape of an intoxicated victim, rape of an unconscious victim. In a day of gun violence, it actually also includes the offense of discharging a firearm on a school ground in California. That's not on the violent offense list. Providing a gun to a gang member is not considered a violent offense. And I could go on and on. Exploding a bomb to injure people, placing a bomb in a church or a school, those offenses are not classified on the violent offenses list as defined by Penal Code Section 667.5. And so I think time and time again, as I've spoken to voters across the political spectrum, they were shocked that these offenses were not considered violent. And had they known, many have told me they would not have voted to pass that because they do not believe it's appropriate for those folks to be eligible for early parole. And let me just tell the folks here in your council, as it is, even without that proposition, most offenders, when they go to state prison, are only serving half of their time anyway. If they're sentenced to 10 years, they're only serving 5 in many cases. And so this is a program to even allow them out earlier than their current credits that they're receiving under prior existing state law. So the California District Attorneys Association strongly urges California voters to get involved. This is one way that they can help to protect our community. A safe community is also going to be a vibrant, healthy, well, and hopefully resilient and wealthy community. And so crime statistics being what they are today, I think that this is one way where the California voters can help. So as I mentioned, it will be a proposition. I actually have petitions here this evening, and I would invite anybody that's interested to see me after the meeting, and I will gladly have you sign a petition that we will send in as a part of our effort, and we will make other petitions available here in the community across the county at various locations so that voters who are interested can support it. But with that, I'll close my remarks, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Dow, and I appreciate the clarification on that one. Why don't we have you sit right there, and if we need to ask you a question, we can alternate between our chief and with you. Questions? Councilmember Moreno.
Like the chief, I would like to assume these are inadvertent side effects, unintended consequences. And so I'm curious from the chief, but especially from you, Mr. Dow, with all that you've been doing going throughout the state to promote this and get people informed and hopefully getting this on the ballot, have you had any pushback or, you know, is there a segment of the population that is against this, or is this pretty much like we just need to get the word out and people are saying, yeah, that makes sense?
Yeah, I can speak to just a little bit of that. There's been nobody that I've approached that hasn't been anything less than dumbfounded and shocked at the provisions that are here under the legislation that we've described, AB 109, Prop 47, and Prop 57. Again, most voters were, in my opinion, sold a bill of goods. There are some who are in opposition to this. I've heard at least one quote from a local public defender on a local TV broadcast that was opposed to it as a means of undermining the will of the voters. I have a real hard time finding anybody that if you explain this to and take the time to explain it to, that has a real problem with it. But I personally don't have any interactions with anybody that have not been anything but, like I say, shocked that this exists.
Very quickly, the opposition that I've heard about has been from people that are philosophically in favor of pretty much reducing prison population at any means possible. And so for those that are in favor of kind of opening the doors rather than methodically and carefully evaluating our prison population before allowing them to be released, apart from that, I haven't had any kind of opposition that's been very strong at all. But I will tell you that the initiative as proposed, the name is proposed to be the Reducing Crime and Keeping California Safe Act. And yet the approved title and summary that came out of Sacramento is Reducing Parole Opportunities for Nonviolent Offenders. Personally find that to be putting us back into square one.
Wow.
With not being objective to the voters in terms of what this act really does. The crimes that I just listed, we're not saying that they're, if anything, we're actually, the people would have the opportunity to say, no, these are actually violent crimes. They meet the Webster's Dictionary definition of violent. To any person of common sense, these crimes are violent, and they should be defined as such. But Given the current climate in much of the state, we're faced now with a title that will go on the ballot unless we successfully challenge it, calling it the Reducing Parole Opportunities for Nonviolent Felons, when in fact it's actually the opposite. It's saying, no, these quote, nonviolent offenses are actually violent.
What about it, what sort of discussion has gone on about possibly reclassifying those that are clearly violent within the code to be violent, or is that such a big kind of hill to mount that's not being done?
Well, that's what this initiative is doing. So this
initiative will actually reclassify them as violent.
That's one of the four prongs that Chief Haley was talking about. Okay. So the number one is to say, we hereby, as the people of California, declare that, you know, these offenses shall now appear in the penal code section under 667.5 as violent offenses. What it won't do, and again, a reason why it's a measured approach and it's not repealing other pieces of legislation, it's not making it a strike for purposes of making it require extra long sentence, which is the violent list, just to tell you, the reason why it was created, there's a violent list and a serious list, and there are two categories of offenses that we call strikes for three strike sentencing purposes. And so nobody ever said, well, we don't think felony domestic violence or rape of an unconscious person should be called violent. Nobody did that. Actually, in the defense of whoever initially wrote the definition for violent offenses, it had to do with taking the very worst offenses and saying that they should be classified as violent so that they spend the longest time in prison. And so it was really the fact that that was a limited list that was taken advantage of when Prop 57 was written, and that most voters did not know what was not on that violent offenders list.
Okay. In further answer to your question, I have also heard through the California Chiefs of Police Association that the governor is not real happy with this. He's not real happy with this effort. It feels like it's an attempt to undermine him and his recent legislative efforts.
Well, I think what's unfortunate, if I was willing to give them a benefit of the doubt that maybe these were unintended consequences, this kind of pushback leads me to believe that maybe it's not as unintended or maybe just no concern about it. I don't know what else to think, but
I agree completely. I think most of these were a fraud perpetrated on the people of the state of California who did not know what they were voting for. Yep. And had they known the exact definitions as they're, you know, now written into law, they would have been appalled.
And I know at the time, I appreciate, especially Mr. Dow, your office, you really attempted to get the word out as much as you could about that, and we all followed suit, but we're a small group, and it didn't work. So I hope you can be successful here. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Sturdivant?
Yes, my question is, you know, when Prop 57 was what came out, there was a press conference, and the police chiefs, and everyone got together, and you had a very clear message. It was very factual. It was where we are today, and it spelled out how bad that bill was, but yet it still passed. So my question is, when in gathering signatures, is there also going to be an effort to educate and get people to really understand the gravity of where we are and what we're trying to do to get to right these unintended consequences and to truly have a Reducing Crime and Keeping California Safe Act?
Yeah, I know the DA is going to want to address this, and I'm going to want to address it as well. The real issue comes down to when you put something on the ballot and at the highest levels of government, you're able to name it whatever you want. You can make it sound like daisies and roses all you can, even though if you get down into the meat, the title has nothing to do with what's actually intended. And again, when you look at the passage of Prop 47, and it's called the Safe Neighborhoods and Safe Schools Act, and you get down to the heart of the piece of legislation, it had nothing to do with either of those two at its very heart. And I believe that that is the major reason that some of these things get passed through our proposition system. Again, as D.A. Dow has already said, this was intended to be named one thing. The writers of the legislation have named it what I think is appropriate. Reducing Crime and Keeping California Safe Act seems to be very appropriate based on my reading of legislation. And then you look at what's actually going to be on the ballot, and it is a farce, and it's, quite frankly, it's a lie. And and so that is the problem. So we will absolutely be getting the word out. This is part of that process. Part of the reason we're coming to the council with a resolution like this is to get the word out, give our voice to the weight of this measure. In most cases, when legislation is passed, I don't come before you and say, pass a resolution. This is that important to us that we get the word out and allow the residents of our communities to be educated through this public hearing process.
And District Attorney Dow, again, just briefly, one of the reasons why it was overwhelmingly passed was, quite frankly, money. The proponents had $13 million purportedly to spend on getting the word out to tell the voters that it was only applying to nonviolent offenders, only nonviolent offenses, when that was clearly not the case. So this was a opportunity where those who had the most money were able to get their message out. Law enforcement typically has not been involved in the political process, at least not the people, the men and women on the streets and the District Attorneys Association, and they have not successfully raised large sums of money before to get the word out to the public. And that's something that I know our California District Attorneys Association is looking at because of the current climate. We think it's important because if your message is not available to the voters, then they will go with what they hear the loudest. And unfortunately, in this instance, they heard the message loud and clear that it only applied to nonviolent offenses, and then afterwards really felt like they were sold a bill of goods, which they were, unfortunately. So we're working hard to raise money right now. Our statewide initiative is, executive committee is. I'm a part of that. And I will tell you that there are a lot of retailers that have lost billions and billions of dollars after Prop 47 passed, which made it a misdemeanor to walk in and commit what used to be a commercial burglary. If it's under $950 today, it's considered not only a misdemeanor, but it's considered shoplifting, not even a commercial burglary anymore. And so I know I've spoken to the owners of the grocery outlet here in Atascadero, up there by Del Rio, and they have told me that they have lost thousands and thousands of dollars since Proposition 47 on a regular basis. And that's the one retailer that I've spoken to in our community that has said it's been a very real impact. And in fact, because it can be done over and over and over again without ever elevating it to a felony, that's why this proposition is needed. That serial theft provision will give us an option on the third offense to use our discretion to maybe charge it as a felony if we think it's important to do so in that particular case. It doesn't mandate it that it's a felony, but it gives the district attorney and judges the at least the ability to make that a felony on the third offense, and we can stop some of these repeat offenders that go day after day after day and commit these theft crimes.
Well, thank you for driving this initiative, and thank you for bringing it to our awareness.
Councilmember Bourbeau.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for coming this evening, Mr. Dow, especially, and thank you, Chief, for the report. You know, this is a good example of unintended consequences, but along those lines, that prompts me to read this very carefully to, you know, wonder about, there's always potential unintended consequences in the solution as well. Although I got to say, this is only 5 pages of small print, and I'm sure the original was a lot more than that. And most of the time, those propositions are, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 pages of unintelligible mumbo-jumbo, and this actually is fairly clear. It's mostly in English, but it does. I do have a couple questions. In particular, regarding DNA collection, in the findings and declaration, but not in the body of the language of the proposition, I guess, it states that individuals not charged with a crime or it makes mention that it does not affect existing legal safeguards that protect the privacy of individuals by allowing a removal of their DNA profile if they are not charged with a crime or are acquitted or are found innocent. So that's currently the policy, and this does not affect that, because when I get into Section 5 on DNA collection, I can't really find that. But is that the case that if somebody is arrested, their DNA is taken under the provisions here, that if they are found innocent, their DNA is deleted, but by that time has it been tested and already, you know, potentially used in other, to put to good use to maybe capture somebody for a different crime?
Want me to answer?
Well, that's a DA question. All right. For sure. Wow.
Well, actually, it's a very good question, and actually the law used to be that on arrest, law enforcement could collect a DNA sample. That changed a number of years ago to where only upon conviction. And so at this point, the DNA sample from anyone that we're adding in at this point, it would be those new crimes that used to be felonies, now are misdemeanors, would now be eligible once again to have a DNA sample collected after their conviction. So it would not be at the time of arrest. That was a problem I kind of identified in years past when the policy and the law had previously provided for collection of the DNA sample at the time of arrest. And so now it's only after conviction. So if they were acquitted, there would be no collection taken.
Because it says in here under the DNA collection section that any adult person who is arrested for or charged with any of the felony offenses, following felony offenses.
Which section are you in?
In Section 5, Section 5A2. And the only reason I'm just concerned about that is, you know, I think it's great that we're using technology to catch people for other crimes, but when people are found innocent, then, you know, they should go to their status quo ante of not being you know, caught up in the system, if you will.
There is some difference between somebody who has DNA evidence collected from them upon conviction of a crime. So, for instance, if you're charged with a felony and you're found guilty and you're sentenced, you'll serve state time in state prison. That really is the defining characteristic between a misdemeanor and a felony. A misdemeanor, usually it's some amount of local time and a fine, or only a fine, or just some local jail time. With a felony, you're talking about state prison. Now, in some of those cases, you'll go all the way through the system, be convicted, sentenced to a crime. No DNA would ever be collected during the investigatory phase of that incident because it wasn't needed for the prosecution purposes. And so DNA is collected at the end, once you're found and convicted of that crime, to put into the database. There are other instances, and I think where you're seeing the difference here, where if you are arrested for a crime, I have the right now legally through the state system as it exists to collect whatever evidence is necessary to aid in the conviction of you for that crime. So if, in fact, I need your fingerprints, I can collect those. If I need a blood sample, under certain circumstances, I can collect those. And under certain circumstances, say, for instance, I'm investigating you and I'm going to charge you with rape, I'm allowed to collect a DNA sample currently. So you're really talking about two different things. One is, if you're arrested, I can collect you or collect DNA evidence if you're arrested for a felony crime. And the other is, upon conviction, later on, even if I didn't collect DNA as part of my investigatory process, now I can still collect that DNA and have it as part of the database, even though it wasn't evidence in this crime.
Okay, let's just make sure I understand it, because obviously DNA is a great tool. Is if you arrest me for a crime and it warrants taking my DNA, so you're investigating that crime, you wouldn't actually compare that to the database to see if I've committed other crimes until after I'm convicted?
So if I have a legal right to collect your DNA at that time for that crime, no, it could be entered into the database, and yes, it could be searched once it's entered, if I had a legal right to do that. In some cases, say you were arrested for petty theft, well, there's no need for me to collect DNA evidence in a case like that. And so the clarification is here that in some cases where somebody's arrested for a felony crime, there was no DNA needed to prove and convict somebody for that crime, say drug possession. I didn't need your DNA. But it was collected after your conviction.
Gotcha.
Okay. There are some cases where DNA is necessary for evidentiary purpose and can be collected. Gotcha. So you're talking about a little bit of apples and oranges there.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. Mike Sermon just said if somebody is, you know, arrested and then ultimately found innocent, then they kind of should be restored to their status prior to that. But otherwise, that sounds good. Chief, you'd mentioned, you talked about the effect of this is maybe having people serve a larger portion of their sentences. Is that strictly as a result of the change in parole consideration so that their whole record can be considered by a parole board? Or does this do anything to actually increase the amount of time served by people?
No, it changes certain crimes can now be aggregated. Theft crimes can be aggregated and be made into a felony.
Right.
But it doesn't change other crimes, and it doesn't change the nature of those crimes. What happens currently is you go before the parole board, and they make a determination on release and whether you should be released. Additionally, not only do they make a determination whether you should be released, they make a determination whether you're eligible for parole. And so there are some people being found eligible for parole that under the provisions of this statute, their whole criminal conduct could be considered. Because, again, in some cases, if you're in jail for a felony drug offense and your parole board is trying to determine whether you should be released or not, and all they have is that one offense, it might look like, yeah, he's eligible. But then if you look back and find out that he has five prior offenses, maybe he's not eligible at all. The additional provision of this, and I apologize for taking so long, but I want to make sure we're clear, is that currently when you commit an offense while you're out on parole, the parole board is not able to, or the parole officer is not able to reincarcerate you based on an individual reoffense or violation of your parole terms. And there are provisions in this act that would allow for, after the third violation of your parole, after the third time you violate a parole, for the parole officer to actually bring you before the board and revoke your parole and send you back into custody. Right.
Yeah, I think it's particularly important that, you know, a parole board be able to consider the entire picture of somebody and like you said, not, well, you know, they only did this one thing, let them go, and then realize not knowing they're a... you know, a repeat offender.
I agree.
So that's very important. In speaking of parole violations, there's just a term I was curious what it meant. Flash incarceration, period of detention in a city or county jail due to a violation of offender's condition of post-release supervision. Sounds like a good thing, but how does that... is that just like, you know, person committed parole violation, we can put them away real quick for at least 10 days
for a specified period of time to kind of wake the individual up and say, hey, stop it and behave yourself. And it had proven very effective in terms of keeping people from getting into a cycle of reoffending and getting reincarcerated and you know, kind of has the opportunity for the parole agent to use that as a hammer, as a tool to say, stop. Right. You really have to follow the terms of your parole release.
And under these previous reforms, that practice ended, and so now this reestablishes that?
Yeah, it not only has that practice ended, but it's changed the manner in which they can do incarceration. Previously, if you violated a term of your parole, it was automatic. You were going back to state prison, and that's no longer the case.
Right, yeah, and I don't know that it should be automatic, but having that option is certainly very important to break that cycle and to get people back on.
And again, that's why the provision is that upon three offenses, I mean, we're not only have you given them the first chance and the second chance, but then you've given them a third chance as well.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Chief, and thank you, Mr. Dow.
Could I make one comment as well? Just as an example, first of all, theft of an automobile under $950 is also considered a misdemeanor because of Prop 47. Wow. If it's over that, it could still be a felony. But there are some who are struggling to get by that their vehicle, though it's under $950, is how they get to work. It's how they get their kids to school. It's how they get around and get and do what they need to do. The other thing I wanted to mention on that is when it's a felony, we had last week Fresno County District Attorney Lisa Smitkamp issued a press release about a case that they had where a person was sentenced in 2016 for two felony counts of vehicle theft with a prior conviction, two felony counts of possession of a stolen vehicle, and also of evading a peace officer, resisting arrest, and possession of burglar's tools. He was sentenced to 5 years back in 2016. Last week, the parole board said that he was eligible for early release under Prop 57, and yet he has many, many prior convictions. He's been convicted prior of residential burglary, second-degree burglary three times, vehicle theft two times, hit and run resulting in injury, grand theft, petty theft of the prior conviction, and possession of a firearm by a felon in over a 17-year period. So he was deemed his current offense to be nonviolent because it was stolen vehicles, and they let him out, and he was only sentenced 2 years ago to 5 years in state prison. They let him out early. His maximum could have been up to 16 years in prison. He was already given a very lenient sentence at the time he was sentenced. But for Prop 57, he would have had to serve more of his time on that five-year sentence, but they decided he
he was eligible to get out early because they were forbidden from looking at his prior criminal history because of the way Prop 57 was written. And that's something that the fourth prong of this new initiative will take care of that, so that the parole board at least will make a decision knowing the entire criminal history of that particular person.
All right. Thank you, and thank you also, Chief, especially for the comments regarding the serial retail theft and those kind of serial small-scale theft things that this corrects, because that's, in my mind, was very definitely, hopefully an unintended, but nonetheless a bad consequence of essentially decriminalizing small-scale theft. So thank you both.
Thank you.
Just one quick question. When I was reading my staff report, I came across some statistics that were stuck in the resolution, and one was since 2013, violent crime in Los Angeles has increased 69.5%, and violent crime in Sacramento rose faster during the first 6 months of 2015 than any of the 25 largest U.S. cities tracked by the FBI, more than Chicago, more than New York. I mean, I find that quite astounding. I just wondered if you, Mr. Dow, could tell us, has the violent crime increased in our county?
In some places it has, and I didn't bring with me tonight those statistics to be able to give to you. I could return at another time, but in some parts of the county it has, and in some parts of the county it's stayed about the same or even gone down a little bit. But property crimes are definitely climbing at an alarming rate, and in certain areas the violent crime rate has as well.
We've been a little sheltered in Atascadero from some of this, and I'm grateful for that. I think it's largely in part due to the efforts of the men and women that are out there, you know, keeping us safe on the Atascadero Police Department. But within the county, as the chiefs have discussed this, Pismo Beach, San Luis Obispo saw, again, high double-digit increases in property theft crimes in 1 year. And then San Luis Obispo's chief has told me that they have experienced a dramatic increase in violent crime within, again, 1 year of the passage of these. So it is hitting us locally. It's only a matter of time before it comes our way. I mean, we'll inevitably see this trend here in Atascadero as well. We can't hold back the tide forever.
Thank you. I thank both of you for this information. I thank you, Mr. Dow, for coming here and making this presentation to us. It's valuable information. I'd like to open this to the public for public comment now.
Hi, Susan Funk from Atascadero. It's my night. I want to preface this in the efforts, as we noted, to have to achieve laudable goals. Sometimes there are unintended consequences, and I want to explore a potential area of that. By way of first a little story, early in my career, I lived in Washington, D.C., and I had a day when I came home to my apartment building on the corner of the street and discovered my downstairs neighbor busy taking all of his furniture out of the apartment and putting it out onto the street. And then he proceeded, and none of us could engage him and get a response that made any sense. And so we started looking for identification and trying to find somebody to call and do something. Meanwhile, my neighbor continued to disassemble and eventually took off all of his clothing and stood on the street corner naked, at which point the police were called because, you know, none of us knew what to do. And this is a situation where the police officers responding to that are confronting someone who is obviously not in control of their behavior, not rational, and not reacting in a normal way to the situation that's coming. It is, in those kinds of situations, very easy to see someone react that the arrival of the police officers or the duty of the actions of the police officers to control the person, to manage the situation, you know, even to throw a towel on him or a jacket or something that for dignity's purposes, that any of those things might be perceived by that person as an attack. And they respond by spitting on the officer, trying to hit the officer, trying to, as they see, defend themselves. It is in that kind of situation that you end up with an assaulting of a peace officer being an offense that can be charged when what was going on was a mental health interaction. And it's a great tragedy that we're all dealing with right now, that the chief's officers are very often our first responders to mental health crises in our community. And we're all struggling with how to have that go down a pathway that ends up with a person who gets the treatment that they need and doesn't end up strapped to a chair in jail with potentially lethal consequences. I hope that the chief could address how this situation can be managed if this initiative goes forward, so that interactions that are mental health in nature do not end up with assaulting police officer, putting a person much more for a longer period of incarceration where they're not able to get their mental health needs met and not able to become restored to their sense of self and to the community.
Thank you, Ms. Funk. We'll answer that question at the end of public comment.
I guess Susan and I are the only ones who want to talk tonight. Ellen from Atascadero. I work at the state hospital, so I've interacted with a lot of inmates. We call them patients because we're a mental hospital, not a jail. And I have to say, I probably was one of those people who voted for this. I forget which number it was. I always get confused on all the numbers. And one thing I've learned over the years is don't vote for a proposition that you don't understand exactly what it is, because it's true. The names are misleading. There are multiple pages, and there's a lot of stuff hidden in there. I wish we could go back to legislating, you know, where people who actually know something or know more than I do can make definitions of what's violent, what's not violent, versus getting caught up in all these little shades of gray and everything. So I'm interested in what you have to say, because I trust that you guys know what you're talking about, but I want to know more about it. And I don't know if you have a website already or anything, but people, because we got tripped up the first time around, we're probably going to want to do our homework a little bit more than we did last time. And it'd be good to have that contact information or website information, because I'm starting to just vote no on anything that I don't know clearly, because there is so much money in politics now that, you know, you can have the plastics industry try to take away recycling of plastic bags because that hits their bottom line, and they can throw as much money into fighting propositions as they want. So, you know, it goes on either side. Whoever has the most money wins, and that's kind of frustrating. So please do your homework and try to find ways to get the right information. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Bernie Reese. I live in Atascadero over by the lake. My first thing, I'd like to come in and give you gratitude here for this police department. I've had many dealings with them. They are fantastic. As Tom Peterson with code enforcement, all relating to homeless issues and et cetera. I have had homeless people come into my garage, ransack my car. They've walked into my kitchen when I've been in my kitchen. I now have to have a rope across my driveway with no trespassing signs. I have a neighbor around the corner who also has had, his wife was in the kitchen in her nightgown when we've had homeless people walk in, because we have a neighbor who takes them in. And we've had many issues with this. If I gave you the address, you'd be very familiar with it. But I just want to tell you that we don't even report it anymore. It's a monthly, daily, sometimes every 2-3 times a week. Maybe we'll go a month. And there's been obscene things done that we've had to endure. They jump the fences and take the fruit off your fruit trees. They empty your garbage. I've had the police over because they go through my trash, and then they throw in, we got a parole, all their papers released from their jail. We even had their name. Because we've had to do that. But it's an ongoing, I think, most of my neighbors we don't call anymore. It's a routine, and we're just all getting very used to it, and it's very sad for our community.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that would like to speak on this? Seeing none, I'll close the public comment portion and bring it back to the council for a motion or discussion. Council Member Sturdivant. I'm sorry. I'm getting late. I'm falling down on the job here. I'm not as good as Tom at this one. Okay. We had a question from Susan Funk regarding mental health and criminal behavior and interaction with the police.
There were actually three kind of comments made that I'd like to address just briefly. The first is if you feel like you're so used to something and you don't want to report it anymore, please let me encourage you to keep reporting it. And I know how frustrating that can be, and I empathize, but we still want to know what's going on in your neighborhood, and we still want to come out and respond, and we still want to give you some peace. We've taken over code enforcement now from the fire department, and we have some dedicated resources to work towards helping you out. So please keep responding. The second was, is there a website? There absolutely is. If you want to get more information about this measure that's proposed, please go to www.keepcalsafe.org. That's keepcal, C-A-L, safe.org. I encourage you, on the website, there's more information and a full listing of what the measure says. So great advice to be educated and be informed. And then as it relates to mental health interactions, I couldn't agree more. Our officers are being called out more and more to deal with things that really don't fall under the purview of law enforcement typically. Those mental health interactions are becoming more an everyday norm for us. We are working with representatives in the county to try and rectify some of that so that other entities who are more skilled at dealing with those things are called rather than police. But we're also working to train our police officers. We encourage the ongoing training through the Sheriff's Department CIT, which is critical intervention training. CIT teaches officers how to deal with individuals who are undergoing mental health crisis, including the art of de-escalation. When we see somebody who is in crisis, how do we take a step back and get that person to kind of come down from that heightened state? I sit on the board for Transitions Mental Health Association. I'm pleased that our organization is working with the Sheriff's Department to complete the upcoming training. It will be a 40-hour block of instruction that will be provided on an ongoing basis so that every member of law enforcement within the county can attend that training. We will continue to work with local resources. And I can assure you that our officers know the difference between somebody who is being violent intentionally and somebody who is being violent because they're in some sort of mental health episode. Most often we work with the district attorney's office to assure that that person gets proper treatment rather than criminal prosecution. In a couple of cases, I myself have been kind of assaulted, and the DA himself has called me and said, hey, is it okay if we handle this a different way? And we've agreed immediately that, yes, that's appropriate in those circumstances. So we don't take a hard stance in those cases. But there are people out there who wish to do us harm. And there are people out there who assault my cops and get them hurt and do so intentionally. And those people are the ones I'm talking about. If you assault a police officer, that's a violent act to me. I pay the cost of that. Our department and our community pays the cost of that. And that's who we're really talking about here.
Thank you, Chief. All right. I'm going to bring it back to the council now for discussion or for a motion.
Just before we make motion, I just wanted to, Mr. Dow was getting to this point, that is, because this 4757 were propositions, they can only be corrected through propositions. So, you know, in other words, you can't, as much as we'd like the legislature to do its job and pass good laws, you know, once something is passed in a proposition, its unintended side effects can only be fixed through another proposition, and that's why it requires that, you know, they go through this process of collecting signatures, et cetera. So.
Thank you for that clarification. Well, seeing none that were making the motion, I'd like to make the motion that the council adopt draft resolution in support of the Reducing Crime and Keeping California Safe Act of 2018.
Second.
Second by Councilmember Moreno. I made the motion. Roll call vote, please.
Councilmember Moreno?
Yes, ma'am.
Councilmember Borbo?
Yes.
Councilmember Sturdivant?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Fonte?
Yes.
Motion passes.
Thank you. Moving on, we have council announcements and reports. Is there anyone with an announcement or a report?
Just tomorrow, we have the Design Review Committee meeting to consider two projects in the community. One is a project by People Self-Help Housing on Santa Isabel, and the second is a residential care facility on Portola.
Thank you. All right, let's move on to committee reports. Let's start with Councilmember Sturdivant.
No report.
Councilmember Moreno.
I have EVC tomorrow, and as our chief mentioned, filling in for our city manager's report, we do have the press conference coming up Thursday at 10 o'clock. We have our chamber CEO here, so excited about that. So anybody who wants to join us, please come out for that.
Thank you. Councilmember Burbeau?
Well, I guess I jumped ahead and gave a committee report, so I don't have anything else. Thank you.
Okay, very good. And I have no report. Okay, is there anybody that is on staff that has any reports or information that the council needs to hear? I see nodding no heads. So with that said, meeting adjourned.